Well, greetings to everyone. It's been a long time since I've been here, and it's been too long. It's good to see everyone again. We were coming up for the evening today, and Bill called me and asked me if I would tell you a little bit about a recent trip that we took. We recently went on a medical mission to Kenya. And, you know, at work, people would say, "Oh, what a wonderful thing it is. You know, it's you'll get to see that part of the world." And it was not a joyful trip. It was not a fun trip. It was a long, tiring trip, and after we got there, we worked almost constantly while we were there. We weren't sightseeing, we weren't, going on safari, although one lady and her two sons who were there did go on safari after the event, but we needed to get back to our jobs. And I will tell you, I could not have imagined what I was going to see. I have not seen anything ever in this country that would have given me the notion of what I would see. And those people there would not have the first notion of how you live. We started on May 28th. It was a medical team from here to there, and it included a university senior who was going on to medical school, who had never taken a blood pressure before. She has done thousands of them now, or at least multiple hundreds of them. And she is expert and has a leg up on a number of skills that she will need as a doctor when she becomes a doctor. We had an emergency medical technician, an EMT. We had one paramedic that was there. We had a chiropractic doctor who was there, that the people in Kenya came to call Dr. Bones. And affectionately called him Dr. Bones. And they were amazed that after a treatment, they would hobble in, they would get on his table, and he would adjust their spine. And you just see the glaze leave their eyes and the excitement come on that the pain is lessened, at least. We had Ellen and myself, and then we had Sabrina and her two sons, Caleb and Luke. Delightful young men. Not with any medical background at all. But and then we teamed up with doctors and pharmacists and nurses from in-country, who were top-notch. They were top-notch. The nurses there, in many cases, do things that doctors do here because they must. Because they have contact with the population and there aren't enough doctors to go around. If we go again, we would like to take another pharmacist. We'd especially like to have a dentist, because we saw a lot of dental problems that we could not address at all. We'd like to take a doctor from here. We had one doctor, Sabrina, in fact. And Luke and Caleb's father is a surgeon, but he's also in the Army Reserves, and the Army would not give him authorization to go to Kenya. He has been to Haiti before, but would not let him go to Kenya because of the more volatile political situation there. Well, we went to, first off, we did go with an organization called 127 Worldwide. And I remember I had my t-shirt on the other day, and I had someone ask me, 127 Worldwide, what's that mean? That's a good ear catcher there. It's based on the concept of James 1:27. And I think it would have been better served on their t-shirt if they had had 1:27 Worldwide. And maybe we ought to mention that to Mary Beth for the future, because people see 1:, and it's easier to make that transition than to James 1:27. Yeah, I don't even think that we need to turn there to know what it says, but we will. Pure and undefiled religion before God and the Father is this: to visit orphans and widows in their afflictions, and to keep oneself unspotted from the world. And it involves both of those things. It involves serving widows and orphans and to keep oneself unspotted from the world. Now I want you to dive back to the beginning of the Bible to, I think it's Exodus 22. I sure hope, no. I've done it again. Oh, I was in Genesis. I'm sorry. Oh, that'll be better. Yeah. Exodus 22 it is. And verse 22. Right above that in 21. We'll start there. It says, "You shall neither vex a stranger nor oppress him. For you were strangers in the land of Egypt." So, you know, we're talking about in idea and in concept more than widows and orphans. But the very next verse brings that in. Exodus 22:22. "You shall not afflict any widow or fatherless child." So we've got strangers mentioned here. We have, or if you will, people not of our faith. People not of our faith. Or it could be strangers. Okay? But you're not to afflict a widow or a fatherless child, because God then says, if you afflict them in any way, said, they're likely to cry out to me. It says, and they cry out to me, I will surely hear their cry, and my wrath shall burn, and I will kill you with the sword, and your wives shall be widows, and your sons will be orphans. Anybody miss the message there? Was that pretty plain talking? That's pretty plain, actually. There are many, many other scriptures that says, and before I went to Kenya, and I never gave my SPS, I'm talking about my trip to Kenya, and the ways that it benefited me, because it benefited me way more than it ever benefited them. I read, went through, it's back there in my attaché case. I don't have it up here. I don't need it. I read, went through the concordance and read every scripture through the Bible that mentioned widows and orphans. Every one of them. And I tried to boil that down into principles. And there were basically three principles. And that is, don't afflict a widow or an orphan. Be good to them. And search them out to help them. And almost, well, I think, of all of the scriptures in the Bible, they would fall in those categories. Not only widows and orphans, but the poor as well. It becomes a challenge how you help them, though. And we'll talk about that just a little bit as well. But 127 Worldwide was begun a few years ago. They are not a Sabbatarian group. But you know what? A starving to death child doesn't really care. And we saw a lot of them. A lot of them. We were in country with 127 Worldwide has what they call is it partner groups?
Yeah.
Partner groups. They have partner groups. One of them is led by a very dynamic man who is a Kenyan of the Luo tribe. And his father was a missionary. And he has become a missionary too. He was orphaned himself as a teenager. And he basically got down angry and prayed to God and say, you know, you've taken my mother, now you've taken my father, and my brother is sick with malaria and is dying. If you don't heal him, then I am done with you for the rest of my life. The next morning, his brother got up, took a shower, and got well. Peter, with his mouth hanging open, he had also said, but if you do, I will serve you for the rest of my life. And he remembered his promise, and he has been about working with widows and orphans ever since. He had an opportunity to be educated at Cambridge in England and did not know what he wanted to do when he when it came time to leave England. But he saw a magazine article, I think it was, like the week before he was due to leave. And it was about the slums of Kibera. And I'll mention that again in a little more detail. The slums of Kibera, and it's like captured his heart, and he says, I'm going to go back there and I'm going to help those people. He is the founder and the head of at a place called the Swahiba Youth Network. And the offices of that organization is right in the slums of Kibera in Nairobi. His wife Julie works with him, and they have two sons and
one son
and one daughter. Okay, see, the wives know the details. Another organization that we went to was the Ashburn Oruhu Medical Clinic in Baragula in Siaya, in Kenya. Siaya would be equivalent to a region or a county, if you will. And Baragulu is the village, nearest village. This was built on land donated by Peter Obungu's grandmother, who is in control of the tribal land. Tribal issues are huge in Kenya. They drive life there. Everybody is part of a tribe. Peter is of the Luo people. You've got the Maasai people. And there are other groups. And much of the conflict that goes on in Kenya is political along tribal lines. The leaders of the various tribes vie for power. And it's like the United States. Let's don't talk politics. Then we went on to a place called Tumaini. That's just north of Kakamega. Kakamega is a town that I forget how many people that were at Kakamega, but it is sort of a region. It's like a county seat. I had it down. Kakamega is 99, about 100,000 people in Kakamega. There are hospitals there. There are facilities there. You get out of town, there's nothing there. Okay. So we took off on the 28th of May, and we traveled, and we traveled, and we traveled, and we traveled some more. And if you're one of those people that can't sleep on an airplane, you are really up a creek. For the first time in my life, I was able to sleep on an airplane because it just went so long. We first
30-some hours.
Yeah.
Travel time.
Yeah. And that is both flight time and layover time in airports where you can't find a place to lay down, so you're sitting up the whole time. We flew from here to Newark, New Jersey, changed planes, waited, and then flew to Zurich, Switzerland, changed planes there. And when you get to Zurich, Switzerland, if you've ever gone to Europe you're about halfway there when you get to Zurich. So it is a long, long way. And with Kenya, you've got Uganda to the north, Somalia to the northeast. Uganda is to the west. It is the Sudan to the north and Somalia to the northeast. And I always called it Tanzania to the south. It's Tanzania, by the way, is the correct. And so we got there. And Peter Abunga picked us up at the airport and then took us to our lodging. It was a Catholic, I think, hotel. They ran a hotel. Now, any decent hotel that an American would stay at there, you drive up, the gates open, and you drive through the walls with the concertina wire on top and armed guards standing inside. Because Kenya and Nairobi is a dangerous place. Especially to whites and to Kenyans as well. But now, I will say, just as a general rule, it's one of the most friendly places on earth I've ever seen as well. You never saw so many smiles, and you've never shaken so many hands as I'll bet you I shook 2,000 hands while I was there. More, I would say. Everybody will shake your hand. Everybody will give you a big smile. They are, by and large, to be so impoverished, a happy people. By and large, I would guess happier than we are as a people. And much, much poorer. Okay. We spent the night there. And did we go to work the next morning?
Oh, yeah.
Yeah. I mean, we went straight to work. We had 6 clinics set up. We spent 2 days in Kibera. We spent, I'm getting the count wrong. We spent 1 day, well, let me just tell them to you as I get to them. We went to a rehabilitation center for boys, a reform school, if you will. These boys are, I had it down between 8 and 16 years old. The 16 years old had the appearance of about 11 year olds. That's what starvation and malnutrition does for you. And they were from all over Kenya. There were about 70 some of them there at the time we were there. And we went there to do physical examinations, basic physical medical treatment. And it's a good thing that we went there first. There were only 70 of them. The last day that we had a clinic, was it 2,000 we saw that day?
No, we didn't see. We saw between 2,000 and 3,000 people in 10 days.
Okay, all right. But it was multiple hundreds we saw on that last day. And we were organizing ourselves. We had all had medical training of some form or another. And we had the locals, but none of us had ever done this. This is the first time 127 Worldwide had done a medical clinic. They've done evangelical clinics, or missions in the past, but this is their first medical mission. So we're forging new territory here. Everybody there had gathered what the hospital would give. I got a bunch of stuff from the hospital. And everybody carried an extra huge suitcase with just what medical supplies we could carry in it as an extra suitcase on the trip. Everybody. And so there are all these suitcases with stuff. Uncatalogued, unorganized stuff. Whatever everybody could get.
Medical
supplies, yes. And one of the things we suggested for trips in the future is add another day if you have to. But take a day and organize before you go. Before you actually go to the clinics. And I think they'll take that to heart. Certainly if I go again, I'll be singing that song, because you lose a lot of capacity getting yourself organized while you're in motion. So we went to Cavite, the rehabilitation center, and we had these little boys there. Now, they were all in uniforms. All the schools in Kenya, all of them, are uniformed schools. Everybody wears a distinctive uniform, and you see children all over the place. Well, these boys were in uniforms as well. When we first drove up, they had them in like military lines waiting on us, and they looked pretty spiffy, you know, at a distance. These boys are here for 3 months for sociological evaluation. These boys had been brought here from all over Kenya for infractions of the law, most of which involved stealing food to survive. It reminds you of the scripture, you know, it says, it's in Psalms, I think it is, where it says, don't give me great wealth in case I should forget God. And don't give me poverty so that I might steal. And these boys didn't have that option. And there's a reason most of them are on the street, and I'll mention that in just a little bit. Well, just shortly here. But they were there, and when you got up close to them, you realized that those uniforms, they're here for 3 months at a time, were ragged and torn and had been passed from the last group that was here. And I would warrant a guess that they were not laundered in between. And so there are many, many difficulties health-wise there, and especially in the youths that are there. Saw one boy that had a pair of gum boots on. Had a pair of, you know, rubber boots. We went to examine him, and we had him to take his shoes off, and he had trench foot. That his, basically, his feet are rotting off. Because it's, now, right now, it's the winter season there. And so the daytime temperature in Nairobi was, low 80s?
No, 70s.
High 70s and nighttime's low 50s. Well,
that's
every day without change, doesn't alter at all. It's wintertime. You see people bundled up in coats with hoods on, little old ladies claiming they're freezing to death because it's winter. And, you know, we're in shorts and, you know, and say, let me unbutton this. It's so hot in here, you know. And at 78 degrees or whatever it was. But that boy had those boots because at another time of the year, you've got the monsoons. And it rains every day. Through the morning, it does not rain. The sun shines. Every afternoon, it clouds up, and then it rains torrentially until the next morning. And so you have water running everywhere. Just like Georgia, it's red, iron-laden clay. That, and I can only imagine what it might be in the rating season down there. Just awful. I mean, and water everywhere. Well, he had these boots, but they were causing a problem. And we told him that you need to not wear your boots. But it's the only thing on planet Earth that he owned, that were his. It's the only identity that he had as an individual was that pair of boots. And we knew he was not going to take those boots off until it got to be a much worse problem than what it was. And that was, I think, to me, the greatest frustration. We were there for one day, trying as best we could to serve a people that needed us there day after day after day for weeks and months. And we knew that we were just shaking a stick at the problem. But we were there, and these children were in the reform school. And what happens after that? They were caught. Well, the problem here stems from African culture. And since that time, I did a sermon on tradition and on culture. The culture, and it extends to us as well, because we have harmful traditions as well. Religiously, culturally, we have things that are killing us as a society. And the Kenyans don't have the same problems, but they have problems that are killing them as a people. African culture. The tribes allow plural marriages, multiple wives. And that in itself is a problem. You know, from the Bible, we understand that the patriarchs, in many cases, were allowed multiple wives. But there is a high level of illegitimate, a large number of illegitimate children born in Kenya. it being what it is, premarital, extramarital sex, I should say, is very prevalent. And so you have a lot of girls getting pregnant and a lot having children. And the problem comes when a girl has an illegitimate son. Because everything in Kenya is tied to tribal land. It's land that can't be sold, not permitted to sell tribal land. It has to be passed down from father to the eldest son in the household. You have a woman with an illegitimate son or daughter is a problem, but women pretty much don't count for much at all in many circumstances. But the illegitimate sons and the mother of that child ultimately gets married, either as a first wife or a second wife, or so on and so forth. Well, if that son is the oldest son in the household, then by tribal law, that son, even though illegitimate, the tribal land would be passed down to that child. The father doesn't want that. And so the solution to that problem is just like people used to do with a stray dog. They would take them down the road and drop them off and abandon them to the streets. And there are lots of them there. Another reason was that the child would be disliked by the primary wife. The first wife, which would be the primary wife. If she didn't like the child, she told hubby to get rid of him. And in many cases, he did. And so we have these children, 8 to 16, who were starving to death on the street, who were rounded up for theft and sent for evaluation. I quizzed Peter Abungu about what happens to these children. They said after their period of evaluation of the 3 months, some of them will be sent on to prison. Some of them will be released back to the streets to fend for themselves once again. And some of them, the brightest of the bright, would go to an orphanage and the possibility of an education. And he said, almost all of them will be dead by the age of 25. It's interesting to have such problems in a society where the greatest benefit that could be given to them would be a clean source of hygienic water, sanitary water, and a bar of soap. And something to eat. You know, always have to get there. We saw scabies, all sorts of skin conditions, bacteria, fungal, respiratory, a lot of respiratory problems there. Malaria is rampant, HIV is rampant, and a lot of festering wounds and things of that nature. Well, that was the first day. We went back, you're sort of bummed at the end of that, you know, and we went back and tried to organize our stuff a little better because we knew the next day was going to be busier. We went to the slums of Kibera. I don't know if you've ever heard of Kibera before, but Kibera is one of the largest, foulest slums on planet Earth. in 4 square miles. If you think about it, 2 miles in that direction, 2 miles in that direction. It's not perfectly square, but that gives you sort of a reference. There are nearly 1 million people. And it's not laid out in nice, orderly streets and conditions there. It consists of a huge rat's warren of corrugated hovels. Ellen's got some pictures of Kibera there. It is, and I'm going to liken it to going to the city dump to live. You go to the city dump and there's commerce up on top. There's commerce everywhere. Everybody there is an entrepreneur. If you're not, you die. Everybody's got something to sell or something to steal or some means to survive. And so that's on top. Then down underneath are the huts. A street, maybe some of the streets I went down were hardly wide enough for me to keep from brushing my shoulders on both sides as we walked down there, with an open sewer running down through the middle. No electricity, except where people have gotten some wire like you would have in a lamp wire. Where you plug a lamp into the wall, spools of that, and they will string it, and it's twisted together and hung overhead and run down into one of these hovels for them to have a light or something of that nature. And you're scared to death the whole time that you're going to touch one of them and get shocked. And there are, as you know, people everywhere. Large families. A typical residence we saw was maybe 10-foot square. And you would have an entire large family living in that space. It was interesting, we went in the house of one widow, and that was one of the things that Peter had us to do while we were there, to take supplies to some of the widows that were particularly devastated. We had one who was very ill, went to the hospital, and she had HIV, I think. But she had a family there, and when we went in, I think it was an aunt of the children there said, "Now that's the kitchen over there," and it was like a burner for cooking, with a blanket sort of hung around the burner, just to segregate it off just a little bit.
Kirby, I don't remember seeing the burner, but I remember seeing lots of like dirty utensils just behind that like curtain.
I didn't really see behind the curtain. So
I was inside.
Yeah.
Because you went in, and my background, I didn't want to sit down, but we had to sit in.
Well, we went in and we prayed with the people. And it's interesting, in Kenyan society, if you present someone with a gift, like we had these big boxes full of supplies, and you went in, you addressed the head of the household, and in this case these are widows, and you thank them for allowing you to come into their home, and you told them that we have some things here, some gifts that we would like to give you. And then it's necessary, after all the greetings are done, after all of the introductions are made, it's very formal, then some designated individual takes each gift out of the box, 5-pound bag of rice, and you present it one at a time until all of the gifts are presented. And the households, the head of the household would then say a few words or words of thanks, and then there would be a prayer, and then we would say our goodbyes, and then and then go back out. So this is we did that in a couple of different locations actually, but in Kibera the stench was tremendous. Sewage, gray water, unwashed bodies.
Flies.
Well, like I said, if you could imagine, every space as big as this podium was a sales stall of some sort or another. I actually saw one woman who had six bananas, and that's what she had to sell. So she must sell those six bananas if she wants to eat. I actually asked Peter, I said, well, you know, are there any rich people here? I mean, are there even people who would come here to exploit the other people and are rich and they come here? And he said, no. The number one focus in Kibera is to get out of Kibera. And so there is entrepreneurship everywhere. Everybody sells something. You'll see somebody with a wheelbarrow selling in the morning, coming in with what amounts to a 250 pound bag of potatoes on a wheelbarrow. Some little scrawny guy that's the potato sack is so much bigger than he is, but he has to sell in order to survive, in order to get ahead, in order to get out of Kibera. Okay. The tribal leaders inside Kibera, and there are tribal leaders there just like there are everywhere else, although it's a conglomeration of different tribes, it's not just one tribe, recognize that education is the key to getting out of Kibera. So they have schools there. Schools in Kenya are pay as you go. If you can't pay, you don't go. Doesn't matter. There is no government-sponsored education in Kenya. It's pay as you go, and competition is paramount. The way it works, if you're bright and lazy, you're going to fail. If you're bright and you work hard and you take your exam and you excel on your exams, then you can petition and get to enter and pay as you go the best schools. If you get through the best schools and you excel in your studies, then you get the best jobs. If you have the best jobs, then you have a chance in Kenya. So competition is extreme. During qualifying exams, the children in Kibera, in Nairobi, Kenya, go to school 12 hours a day, 7 days a week, until the exams are over and the results are back. And then those that are on the bottom will get dropped out. Those that are on the top will be able to move on. Those that are in other places will go to lesser prestigious schools and have a chance. And the thing is, it's once in a lifetime. You won't go back there again. This is your one and only chance to get out of the system. And then possibly the very brightest of the very brightest might have a hope of going on to college. We spent 2 days in Kibera. The third day, we did have a rest day that day, right? We went. We went to the airport.
Yeah.
And then we traveled to the city of Kisumu. Kisumu is the third largest city in Kenya. Just a little over 400,000 people there. So it's about like Lexington, Kentucky now. Airport there. Then we got on a van and we had really what amounted to our first experience with Kenyan roads. Because we are in much more of a rural area at this point in time, Kenyan roads are hard to explain, except that on our return to Nairobi later, we were on a rural road, and I had to pee really bad. And you've heard the term cobblestone roads? Washboard roads. That's where you have the grooves in there. Well, imagine a washboard where the ridges were about that deep, and a van moving at about 20-30 mile an hour, and your bladder's so full you can't stand it. It's like somebody taking a jackhammer to you. I leaned over and told Ellen, says, I think we're going to have a problem here. I was so glad to get back to the hotel, and Kirby ran out of there. So, but that's not the only feature of Kenyan roads, because imagine, well, it's hard to imagine. I've never seen anything like it anywhere. But you've got a direction. They drive on the left like the Brits do, because the British colonials were there for so long. And so they drive on the left, and there are we don't ever complain about chug holes here in the United potholes here in the United States. You've never seen the like. These are potholes that could bury a car, and people coming at you trying to avoid the same pothole that you're trying to avoid, and everybody just going like this as fast as they can go, which is not very fast, and then have that cobblestone effect at the same time. It is just Eastern Kentucky with no rules. It is just a horrendous road system. I understand in Uganda to the west, they have expended a lot of money in infrastructure and actually have some pretty decent roads over there, but not Kenya. So we flew into Kisumu, took the van to a place called Siaya, which is where that little hospital was. And it's also where Peter Obungu's grandmother lived. And a very, very gracious woman. She fed us on several occasions while we were there at the clinic that was there. They have a clinic there, and it's the best described as a row of rooms down three sides of a central courtyard that's covered over. It's all roofed over. There is no air conditioning there, and they don't need really heat, because when we were going from there to the next location, we actually crossed the equator. There's this little clinic. They have a resident doctor. They have a couple of nurses. They have a pharmacist there. And they have some basic lab capabilities. They are very, very much in need of additional laboratory capabilities there. They are they are barely on a shoestring, barely surviving as an institution, simply because they don't have the resources that they need. They need two particular pieces of equipment that by American standards would not be that much, a few thousand dollars, and yet they don't have it. So people have to then go, if they get medical treatment at all, to Kakamega or CI of the town, and or into Kisumu to get medical treatment. But most people just do without. I wish there was some way that I could arrange to get them those two pieces of equipment so that they could have a better situation for the people there.
What kind of equipment are you talking about?
It's an ultrasound machine, and was one of them.
A hemogram,
yeah.
Blood work.
Yeah.
I think they're both like $8,000 a piece.
Yeah. Which is a lot of money for an individual, even here, but it's just off the charts there. The Kenyan shilling is 1 penny, American currency. While we were here at this clinic, it was interesting. We had one fellow there with diabetes, had a diabetic ulcer that pretty much covered his entire lower leg. Here, the doctor would do debridements of that wound and dress it. And that young man, I would say 30s, the nurse, the Kenyan nurse, I've got the greatest respect for them, she took a scalpel and she debrided that wound that covered almost the entire lower leg. She debrided it. There was not one bit of anesthetic.
We couldn't find the lidocaine. So she just went for it. She said, "Do you want to do this?" I said, "No, you go
right here." Yeah. And he winced and he grunted, but he stood and he bore up under that pain. These are wiry, strong people because they walk or ride bicycles everywhere, mostly walk. A lot of motorcycles. Strange things you see. Our chiropractor friend said he saw one person carrying a couch on a motorcycle.
Yeah, I saw that.
Yeah.
Yeah, they balance everything on those motorcycles.
Yeah.
You'll see a whole family, like four people on a motorcycle.
The most I ever saw on a bicycle was three. One guy pedaling and with two passengers. One up on the handlebar, one on the back there. And you think about being strong enough to pedal around with yourself and two other people on a bicycle, motor scooters and the other. A lot of what I thought at first when I first saw it were people traveling under their arm, they'd have it look like a culvert pipe, and I thought, why are so many people running around with these culvert pipes under their arm? And then I got a closer look, and these were actually rolls of corrugated metal because so many of the huts there are made with sheets of corrugated metal. So a guy got a little money ahead, so he went and bought him a roll of corrugated metal and took to his hut and tacked a new piece on. There were a lot of unfinished houses in Kenya, and it's just rough poured concrete, reinforced with reinforcing, but it's concrete that hadn't been vibrated when it was poured. So there are big gaps and holes and voids in the concrete. And I asked Peter about that. I said, "Why? I've seen so many unfinished houses." He said, "Well, they don't have the money to finish it, so they save until they can add a new piece on. They do that work, and it'll sit there for a year till he has some more money to do another piece. And it may take 30 years to build a house because you just simply don't have the money for that. But if that is wealth in place that then can be passed down to the future generation. So many things. I talked about the road, the local life. A lot of the people in the communities are congregated along the roadways. I told you about the lady with the six bananas, and that's all she had to sell. People selling parched corn on the cob. It's the only thing that I ate out in the community while I was there. I thought, and they make their own charcoal. They've got these little charcoal grills. They get corn, they put on the grill, they parch it, and then they sell it by the ear. And it was really good. It was, if you like parched corn, it was quite good. I did not drink the water anywhere at any time in Kenya. I drank bottled water the whole time.
Was it difficult for you to bring that water in, your bottled water?
Do what now?
Was it difficult for you to have that bottled water?
Well, they bought it there. They have bottled water for sale there, so they actually bought it there. So corn everywhere. The grain crop in Kenya at one time was millet. After corn was introduced, corn was much easier. Continuous crop rotation. You've got somebody digging up new ground for corn. You've got corn at every stage of development, and you've got corn being harvested continuously. And Peter said that you grow corn in Kenya or you starve. There's no middle ground there. Cattle's another thing that they do. Here, you know, we have a roadway, and a ditch, and a fence, and a field with cattle in it. There, you have a roadway and cattle. Right on the edge of the road, every place there is a couple of cows, there is a cattle herder there. Some of them would be staked out, some of them would be attended by the cattle herder. Very few goats that we saw. Cattle everywhere for milk and meat. But you didn't see much meat. They sold some in the streets on the charcoal grills, but I wasn't brave enough for that. In this area and in Kibera, they had we saw one gruesome thing. Walking down the street, and here is this huge, maybe the size of this table here, of fish heads in a tropical climate. Laid out there this morning sometime, and about 10,000 flies swarming it. It's my understanding that they take those fish heads and they make soup out of it. And with the maggots that go with it, I suppose. But it would have to be that way. So we had two clinic days at the Ashburn Aruhu Medical Clinic in Siaya. The one guy who had the diabetic ulcer, the doctor saw him and said, he's got to be admitted to the hospital here for 3 days of IV antibiotics if he's going to get well. What's the bill? It's pay as you go, just like the schools. The hospitals cannot give any kind of gratis work. There's no insurance. There's no government subsidy. It is, here's a hospital. If you can pay, you can stay. He could not pay. 3 days, 30,000 shillings. Now remember, a shilling is a penny. So that's 3 days in the hospital. Now you think about what that'll cost you here. 3 days in the hospital there runs $30. And he couldn't. He didn't have the money. So collection was taken up. He got to stay for the 3 days. That's nothing for us. Nothing. You know? But, you know, if somebody came to me coming to the hospital here, and what's a hospital day cost here now? With doctors, well, it depends, you know, but just the hospital's going to be a good $2,000 a day, at least. So it's going to be $6,000-$10,000. And if somebody told me, says, you've got to go to the hospital and you've got to pay me right now, or else we can't treat you, then I would have to go. And that's what life is there. So they're extremely poor.
Can I ask you a quick question?
Yes.
What about cell phones? Did you see any cell phones?
All over the place. Everybody's got a cell phone. I never saw so many cell phones in my life.
It's because that's how they keep their money. It's all like on the phone, you know, their bank, through their bank. I don't know how they do it.
I don't know how the system works, but there are these little cell phone shops everywhere where you can get credits through the phone somehow to get actual money out of your account. So it's sort of a combination of cell phone bank.
Let me tell the girls one thing.
Yeah.
Those women.
Oh,
here
yeah.
They are. They're down in this slum area. And every one of them is dressed to the T. The hair is, you know, all of them have all the braids. And each braid represents a different tribe, the way they braid their hair, too. But anyway, I was like talking to some of the nurses. I said, What's going on here? I mean, they're down in the slum area and they're dressed so beautifully and their hair is lined up. Like, well, they wear their one dress every day. It costs them probably a lot of money and they just wear that every day and they all fix each other's hair. So it's amazing how good they look, the women. So it was interesting.
One of the, in our medical supplies, one item that was greatly sought was one bottle of deodorant. And I had one of the guys looking at that, and he said, would it be possible if I got that, you know? And I said, well, absolutely, you know.
Or the checks. I had some checks that were donated from our hospital.
Oh, yeah, yeah.
And those nurses, they were like, you know, I've got baby at home. I said, take them.
Well, they would actually cut them up into size and use them as diapers, too.
Now, what are you talking about again?
The absorbent pads that they use in the hospital. And they don't have the diapers there, so or they're expensive. So when they saw those, they were going to take those and cut them up into appropriate sizes for their babies. And so we did. We felt really frustrated. We had one experience where we went to a widow's house. It was back out in the Siaya area. And she was a widow indeed. She lived, and you've always seen the pictures of the grass-thatched huts that are mud huts with grass thatch, and the huts are made by driving poles in a circle in the ground, then taking vines around that and then packing mud on both sides, and it dries and creates a solid wall. And then they put the grass thatch on top. The grass thatch is about that thick. And really, I guess during the monsoon season, actually succeeds in turning the water before it drips through, all the way through into the house. So they stay pretty dry. But this woman, now talk about Social Security. In Kenya, there is no government-sponsored Social Security. A woman's Social Security consists of her sons. The elderly are cared for by the family's sons. Daughters are of no value to the family because they will be married off and married into another family, and they become a value and a benefit to the family that they marry into. This woman, she was about the same age of my daughter, Laura. She looked like she was 70. A hard life. She had no sons. And her husband had died young. So she had no money, no assistance, and no hope. She had four daughters and no sons. So the daughters were gone. And she was there, there was a daughter still there. And the daughter had children, didn't she?
Wait a minute, you're not talking about the one that was the age of Laura then.
Okay, well then.
There was an elderly widow that we went to see.
Well, that's the one I'm talking about.
Okay.
Okay. Well, okay, so she did not have anybody there except herself. Okay. And her dogs. Yeah, which little pup that the chiropractor stepped on, and it squalled the whole time we were there. So, but so they gave her some assistance too. The good thing they have going for them is that it is a complete community. That everybody around they had the church community there as well.
That helped her. The minister that was taking us to the different huts where the widows were, he rides a motorcycle there, and he led us there. And I found out just this week that one of his daughters got run over. And so, you know, he's doing all this work with the widows and orphans and stuff, and his own child gets run over this week. So. Yeah. Remember him.
Well, and so, and then this woman, they remember the scripture that we read, Exodus 22:22? A few days before that, somebody had broken in. There are no locks, but somebody broke into the back of her mud hut and stole what little money she had. I wouldn't want to be that individual when God exacts judgment there. So destitute. Talked about needing a well. You see people, children. And you actually see the thing where people have it on their head and they're just walking down the road just as calm but little children carrying 5-gallon cans of water. You know what a 5-gallon can of water weighs? About 40, 45 pounds. And little kids about this size carrying these 5-gallon pails of water. They go down to the creek and everything goes in that creek. And they get water for use at home. And very unsanitary condition. The fourth, on our way to the fourth clinic, we got on the roadways again, and we actually crossed the equator. We stopped. We sort of celebrated for a few moments as we crossed the equator. Oh, and backing up at the clinic, we had someone make a statement there. The first day was a pretty good turnout of the locals to come and get medical treatment. But the second day, they came in a flood. Because the first day, they had heard about it, and they thought it was a joke. And then people started filtering back to the community and saying, no, it's real. There are actual people there giving us medical treatment, you know. And so they came in droves that second day. And somebody says, we just couldn't believe that white people would come from the United States and put their hands on us and touch us. Which is sort of a sobering thing to hear, you know. So we got on the road. We got to the equator. We stopped. And there's a fellow there that somebody brought up how water swirls in the northern hemisphere clockwise. And it's supposed to swirl counterclockwise in the southern hemisphere. He said, here, he'll show us. So we walked, and they actually had a brick line marking the exact location of the equator. The Kiwanis Club in Kisumu had erected a monument there and put this brick line in the dirt. You walk 10 feet to the north of the equator, and he had this pail with a hole in the bottom. He poured water in, and then he stuck a match, floated a match in the water, and it swirled to the right, you know, clockwise. And so then we walked 10 feet to the south of the equator. Now, this is not a great distance, you know, 10 feet, 10 feet, 20 feet difference, and did the same thing, and it swirled counterclockwise. So then he said, now, let me show you this. So we went dead straight right on top of the equator, did the same thing. It didn't swirl at all. It flowed right straight down. Just really neat to see, you know. So we saw corn, cattle. And by the time we got to our next destination, we were in sugarcane country. So they produce sugar there. It's a place called Tumaini, the Miles of Smiles Orphanage. And you want to see the biggest smile you ever saw in your life. You tell one of these children at the orphanage, I'd like to take your picture. And they're sort of stoic at first, you know. And you take their picture, and they've got this stoic smile, stoic face on. And you show them the picture, and they'll have a smile up to their temples, you know. It's they enjoyed it so much, and they're so cute. The woman who runs the Tumaini orphanage is a woman by the name of Rose Bugusu. And she grew up in that area of Kenya. She grew up poor, but she had a sister that sponsored her to go to school in Nairobi. So she was able to get through the primary and the secondary school system. There's a big story there that I don't have time to tell, but she is a remarkable woman. She is an absolute... it's a fantastic story because she has struggled for years with the concept. When she was still in, was it high school or middle school? Ninth grade, she had determined that she was going to go back and start an orphanage. And so she actually has worked all of her life to do this. Was not able to go on to college, just could not afford it. And so it came and it plopped down in her lap. There was a scholarship that a school had, and somebody knew her, came to her and asked if she would like to go there and study. It was a church school. And she said, well, yes. I mean, an education is all important in Kenya. And so she was able to get that. She went back and she wanted to start this orphanage. She actually started it while she was working in Nairobi. And the reason you fly from Nairobi to Kisumu is because the van trip between the two is 9 hours over those cobblestone roads. And it's just unbelievable. So, She started this orphanage, paying for it out of her wages, working as a secretary in Nairobi. And then she caught the attention of her boss, who was impressed by the work that she was doing there, and he helped her. And then they slowly were able to get other assistance. But it's just like the youth center in Kibera, to where it's just barely going. Do you remember how many children she has there now?
I think like 200.
Yeah.
200. She gets like one a week.
On my Facebook page, I had a picture of me holding a little baby from the orphanage there. And they were giving me a hard time, and I posted, says, I still know how to hold a baby. You know? The hard thing is that 2 weeks after we left, she died of respiratory difficulties, and they simply, over those roads, could not get her to the hospital in time. Rose said, now we've saved these kids from starvation. Now we've got to educate them. It's pay as you go. So Rose solved that problem by starting a school. Very difficult, very expensive. Slowly came together. They started with two or three primary grades. And so they're up through high school now. And some of their students go on to college. But then Rose thought, we've got those, to get the land for the orphanage and the school requires tribal approval from the tribal chief. So she went there. She, after a lot of effort, was able to get tribal approval. The tribal chief agreed. She still didn't have the money. So the guy selling the land saw what she was doing and said, you don't have to make a payment. We'll set it up on payments, but you don't have to make a payment until you're able to get the money for the first payment, which was an event that enabled the orphanage to be built. Okay, so they have education, but Rose thought, we have those people who are not capable of going on to high school and college. Said, we can't just abandon them back to the streets. So she is now in the process of establishing a vocational school. Auto mechanics, sewing, secretarial training, things of that nature. Something for both the boys and the girls to give them marketable employment. And they're also then going to produce products for sale to support the school. And so she was able, through a grant from an Australian benefactor, buy the land for the trade school. And that's pretty much where she is at this point in time. Just barely making it, but Rose is, she's a tough woman. So. Okay. Kenyan culture is dichotomous. There are rich there. There are incredibly rich, and there are incredibly poor. You see a lot of expatriates there, British, even Americans, driving. One of the terms they use is for wealth is they drive cars. They have malls there. You can go to, it wasn't Starbucks, it was Java House, which is like Starbucks. You can go to top-end eateries there. You can get gourmet food there. You can go to stores there. Yeah?
Do
when you went into a mall or a grocery store, they had armed guards, so they had to check everything that you had before you could go in.
Yeah.
So,
yeah. Did you have felt safe eating there?
Oh, we did eat there. Yeah, we did eat there. The beverages we had, other than water, were all bottled beverages, though. Sodas, they're big on sodas. Have one that's sort of a pineapple soda. It's really good. So, the culture is divided. It's divided between the haves and the have-nots. And there's a huge gap between them.
Can I ask a question while I think about it?
Yeah.
You said that each of you had a suitcase with medical supplies.
Right.
Yeah. Did your supplies last the whole length of time, or did you run out, or what?
There were things that we needed that we didn't have, and things that we had too much of.
But God supplied every need that we had, because when we were starting to run out of something that we really needed, none of those patients came to us. It was just like whatever was needed, God provided for us. You know, just getting everything set up and organized, you know, taking the time at the beginning, we were all unorganized, and it just worked out so that by the time of the end of it, yeah, you know, we were able to see tons and tons of people because we become organized, and that's, I just feel like it was all God helping us to get everything under control, because none of us could have done it ourselves.
It is interesting. They are Protestant there. They're not Sabbatarian. But like I said, the orphans don't care. The widows don't care. They have something to eat. And that was the important thing at the time. So we went to one of their Sunday services there. Animated people. Just songs and dance I think probably Peter was educated in Britain. It was probably Anglican that he had as a background.
Was he white or black?
He was black. Yeah, he was native Kenyan. And it was interesting. The day before their Sunday school, which was the Sabbath, it was dusty inside the church building, and so they wanted to cut the dust for services the next day. They are very devout. I will say that of them. And so they got the third graders, and they went out into the pasture there and collect all of the cow pies in the pasture. They added water, stirred it up into slurry, and so here are the third graders on the floor of the church spreading manure all over the floor of the church. And the outside around the edges to keep the dust down. It does a very good job of that, by the way.
It smells horrible tonight.
It does. It smells pretty
during
bad.
During service, you didn't smell anything.
No, it had dried by the next morning. There was no dust. And it just shows you the nature of the problem in Kenya. These are cultural things. This is native culture and natives doing what comes natural to them and that they have done for hundreds of years and thousands of years. And the problem is that it is a destructive culture. But then I submit that our culture is destructive too. It's in just a different way. And different dangers and different destructions. You notice that the people there make effort to succeed within the confines of their existing culture. The people in Kibera, the slums, want to sell, to make money, to get out of Kibera. And it has failed them And yet they keep wanting to work harder and harder and harder in an effort to make it work. And is that not what we do? We live in our own version of a destructive society, and we want to make it work, and it doesn't work. There is, just like it is here, there is one solution to Kenya's problems, and that is the return of Jesus Christ. I would admonish you to get and to listen to, however, it's a movie. It's a documentary. It's called Poverty Incorporated. Because you have movie stars running all over Hollywood, all over New York, doing benefits, doing concerts for the poor in Kenya and other places.
And their hearts are in the right place.
And their hearts are in the right place, but they're destroying Kenya in the process. How it works is this. You've got governments. The United States, we saw all sorts of USA aid, medical supplies there. You have the first world sending rice to feed these poor, starving to death people. And in the process, the rice producers in Kenya can't sell their crops. Because why would you buy rice for three times the cost when they're giving it away down the street? And so the industry that is in place in Kenya and other African countries is going down the tubes because of the aid that we send. It's one thing to feed a person, but they don't stop. Once they start, you have foreign governments, the United States, Britain, Australia, the First World, making agreements with the Kenyan government to give them this stuff. Kenyan industry is going down the tube in the process and making the problem worse. And they also have what they call NGOs, non-government organizations, CARE, Feed the Children. All of these organizations that are, and they tug on your heartstrings to tell you to send money so that little Johnny, you know, can be taken care of. But little Johnny's father, who is a rice producer, just went bankrupt because of the free rice that came. He said, they pointed out that the problem is not that the Kenyans are not smart enough. He says they're smart enough to solve their problems. They have the resources. He says the British came there because of the resources that that country had, and they pillaged the resources away from them. And it's not that they don't have the resource. It's not that they don't have the smarts. It's they don't have the access to the global economy. Give them help at accessing that global economy and they'll work out their own problems. You might have to give them some food to keep them from starving for a while, but don't give them so much that you are destroying them. They talked about one software manufacturer, software producer, a Kenyan software company. He developed a software, but because of the agreements between the Kenyan government and these NGOs and these other governments, they wouldn't buy his software because they had agreements for it to be produced in Europe. And so what did the Europeans do? They came to him to develop it and to give it to them, they sold it under a contract with the Kenyan government, and then he had to do the work. But he had to.
Yeah, and he didn't get the pay that he would have gotten.
No.
He got the work, he just got it through the back door.
Poverty Incorporated. We just saw it a couple of weeks ago, and it's sort of eye-opening. And it shows how the system works. One of the NGO organizers was a British fellow, and he says, it made me rich. Because there's money that gets coming back to the NGO for providing relief for these poor, downtrodden, stupid, you know, incapable people.
What's NGO actually stand for?
Non-government organization. Care, feed the children,
organization.
They get kickbacks.
To keep the people poor, basically.
Yeah. Yeah. So, money versus empowerment. The churches are guilty, too. Because they use the poverty of the people as a tool for evangelizing. They want to feed these people, but what they want most is to save them, because if they're not saved now, they're going to hell. And they believe it. I mean, they believe it, but it's a system that is dysfunctional and that will only be changed. Now, I am sorry to say that I don't know any, or at least many, Sabbatarian groups who are working in that kind of work. Certainly, I don't think the Church of God is. LifeNets is the only organization I know of that nature. But I wonder, with all of the admonitions that we have in the scripture. In Deuteronomy, it says, you know, if there are poor among you, it says, well, let's just look at it. I can't find it.
Is it 22:22?
No, it's not that one. But I'll paraphrase. It says, if there are poor among you, and then just down the page it says, there are always poor among you. There will always be poor. He says, you must open wide your hand to help them. And then we have Luke 17, verses 7 through 10. I'll go ahead and read that one. I'm about ready to shut up. I know I've been up here a long time. Got a passion for it at this point, though. Luke 17. Starting in verse 7. In verse 6 he was talking about faith, and then in verse 7 he said, but which of you, having a servant plowing or shepherding, will immediately say to him when he comes in from the field, come on in, sit down, eat with me? Rather will he not say to him, go out and get my food for me. Prepare what I may eat, and gird yourself, and serve me with eat and drink. Come in and serve me now. You've been working all day. Come in and serve me, and afterwards you may eat and drink. Then in verse 9 is the pertinent question here. It says, is he thankful to that servant because he did the things that were commanded him? Is he grateful to that servant because he did what it was that was his job to do? And Jesus says, I think not. Likewise, you also, when you have done all the things that are commanded you, say, we are unprofitable servants, because we have done that which we were obligated to do. Well, God has obligated us in the Scriptures to take care, to open wide our hands to the poor, to open wide and to take care of the widows and the orphans of this world. That's our obligation. And so we can't pat ourselves on the back and say, we went to Kenya, we did a great thing. That's our obligation. Now maybe you don't have to go to Kenya. You know, we have poor here. We don't have poor here like they have poor there. And if you have an opportunity ever to do that, go. Because it will enrich your life. But it is nothing that you can claim special, because it is an obligation. The thing we have to do is to be smart about how we do it. Because there are people out there getting rich off of the backs of poor people. And we always thought, well, they're fine organizations. Some of them may be. But there are hucksters everywhere who are willing to let a child starve so that they can live in a mansion. And that is ungodly. But to be on a positive note, God will help us to do what it is that we are obligated to do. And He, it says in Exodus, I think it is, He will reward for those who go beyond and do what they can.
Thank you, Kirby. Yeah.
Thank you.